95.9 WATD, Mission to Burma, no stranger to the Boston area, and all of the local listeners who know that band well and saw them in many of the clubs that are featured in this great new photo album with some copy or written text in there called Punk, Post Punk, and New Wave. The photographs are by Michael Greco, and a lot of introduction and great stuff by Jim Sullivan, who we have on the line. If modern technology is working, Jim, how's it going tonight?
This isn't so modern, Chris. This is just the old telephone. Yeah. It's the blower, you know?
Are you calling from those the bank of phones outside the Rat in Kenmore Square?
Yeah, that's where I am. I got to put another dime in. Hurry up.
Yeah, and grab a slice at the Kenmore Pizza Pad?
The Pizza Pad, yeah. It was. Yes. A good memory, my friend.
Oh, yeah.
I remember seeing Lux and Ivy of the Cramps after seeing the Cramps at the Rat.
Oh, wow.
At the Pizza Pad. We went in for our slices and sat down to eat, and there was Lux and Ivy. And at the time, this was pretty early, I hadn't met them yet, and their show was so fascinating and fierce and intimidating. I didn't dare go over and say anything. I just kind of went to my friend, hey, there's Lux and Ivy. And that's about it. Later in life, having interviewed them a number of times, I found out they are both about the sweetest people in the world off stage. Absolutely.
And that's what I've found with so many of these bands. I mean, they're obviously intimidating when you're young, even when you're old and you're meeting them or seeing them. But you go backstage and you have a conversation, they're just normal people, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, there's exceptions, of course. Yeah. Johnny Thunders, for instance, when I went backstage to talk with him, he tried to steal the black leather jacket that I was wearing because I'd made the mistake of taking it off. This was at the old Jonathan Swift's club in Cambridge.
Yeah.
I took it off. It was hot. Put it down. And Jesus, he took it. He was taking it. And I just kind of went, hey, that's mine. And he put it down. He wasn't a big guy. I was bigger than he was. He put it down. He didn't give me any fight. But I forgot the first rule of what junkies do. You know that, don't you, Chris? What do junkies do? Junkies lie and junkies steal.
They lie and steal, yeah.
Lie and steal. So anyway.
Do you still have that leather jacket?
No.
Okay. I still have my black motorcycle jacket, you know, with all of that, the sweat and the smoke sort of like just like pressed into it.
Yeah, sure. I think I lost mine in a basement flood or something.
Oh.
But there are others. But at the time, it was very precious to me. And anyway, but to your point, absolutely. I mean, I've met some great people after seeing them play, and the intimidation factor is, well, very low at this point.
It is.
Kind of come to realize they're folks just like you are. They're doing their job. You're doing your job. And, you know, certainly made some good acquaintances, good friends that way.
So you were a reporter for the Boston Globe for about 25, 26 years, covering sort of the nightlife of Boston. Michael Greco, photographer for the Globe as well.
Herald.
The Herald. Oh, I'm sorry about that. Yeah, so the Boston Herald.
He did the Herald and Boston Rock, and he was, just real briefly, I mean, he was an AP photographer, AP photographer, and did a lot of straight things during the day, and then jumped into the punk scene at night. And so he led his double life that way, and went on to a very successful career as a fashion photographer, high-end photographer, magazine photographer, and then kind of, I guess, didn't rediscover them. He knew he had these photos, but I think, you know, he was urged to, hey, why don't you put something together? And he did that. He got in touch with me, and that's kind of how the thing got rolling.
Yeah, it's a great book. We're going to dive into it. We'll stage dive into it. Punk, Post-Punk, New Wave. Photographs by Michael Greco. You've done the introduction for it, which is incredible read. It brings me right back. And tell me, how did you guys get Fred Schneider of the B-52s to come up with a foreword for this incredible book?
I know
book?
Fred. It's just simple connection, I think that's all. I know him. We batted around a few different names that we thought might be good. And, you know, I mean, there's different, you know, you could go in different directions for this, obviously. And I know some people have said to us, well, Fred wasn't particularly punk, was he? And I said, no, not really. But he was a punk fan. Mm-hmm. The B-52s formed because of punk.
Right.
So if you want to call the B-52s New Wave, which is a term that, you know, often got disparaged, but fine, you know, that's the basket they probably fall into. So he kind of we didn't know what he was going to say, but what he did say was very good, because he talked about forming the band, just mm-hmm. being very inexperienced, being punk fans, going to see the Sex Pistols in Atlanta, as did I. That's another story. Why was I there? That kind of thing. Well,
yeah, why were you there?
I was visiting a friend, and it just happened to be, with the cancellations that happened elsewhere, it just happened to be the first date of their U.S. tour.
Wow.
And of course it was sold out. I bought tickets for my friend that I was staying with, and for, I think it was $40 a piece from a couple of kids in line. And we were there. But anyway, so anyway, just to talk about Fred, I mean, he just had a good perspective. I mean, sort of, and, you know, he talked about his, early days and that buzz that comes when you start out with nothing but you and your friends in a garage or wherever. And then suddenly you're playing CBGBs and hurrah and whatever, and people are lining up around the block to see you, and suddenly you realize this thing that you concocted has made sense with a whole lot of other people.
I absolutely agree. And I was never in a band. I always wanted to be in one, didn't know how to play an instrument, you know, couldn't really sing, but it was that whole punk ethos, which I was like, okay, when I get to college, 85, mm-hmm. I'm going to become a DJ. And
right.
So, and here I am 35 years later, still doing it, still sort of keeping that punk, post-punk new wave anthem going,
right.
Wherever and whenever possible. And that's the beauty of all of this stuff that you guys crammed packed into 240 beautiful pages of photographs and, some commentary, throughout. Take us back to, for the listeners, there's so many people that listen to this show that are from the Boston area that, mm-hmm. that lived it, but there's also a lot of people that are streaming this around the country that, they're trying to figure out what was Boston like in 1978 to 80 or 91. So take us back. What was it like for you when you first got here, the music scene?
First of all, the title is a little bit of a stretch, because, I mean, Michael, although there are photos up to 91 or so, Michael was here from those late 70s through the early 80s. He mm-hmm. went off to work for, I think, People magazine first and then elsewhere. So the bulk of it, and the bulk of what we're talking about in my essay, is that late 70s, early 80s scene, not so much late 80s or 90s.
Just, okay.
FYI.
Sure.
So anyway, I mean, the question being, what was it like, sort of? That's the open-ended question?
Yeah, that's like, okay. When you hear, you move to Boston, it's 1978.
Yeah.
What was it like? And I guess sort of the follow-up question to that is, why do you think Boston at the time was such a mecca for this type of music?
Well, let me start with the second question first, because it was a mecca because several things. College radio station was immensely good mm-hmm. with, five or six stations programming this music, and to an audience that was very receptive, college students and others. From a band point of view, especially some of the bands from England, the Police, the Jam, what have you, it was attractive because it was so close to New York.
Sure.
And it would often be the stop before New York being the primo gig, I suppose, where you're playing in front of industry and record company people, et cetera. In Boston, I wouldn't exactly call it a warm-up town or a tryout town, because it was a very avid rock scene, punk rock scene of its own, but it was convenient, and the clubs were there. You know, there was the plethora of clubs now long gone that had this music, and I mean, it wasn't unusual for those of us who did these kind of things to, really have a choice of maybe three or four very good shows in any particular night, and sometimes catch a couple or three of them, sometimes not, but I mean, the it was just an immensity, if that's a word, of choices on a nightly basis. And I know some people have posted, say, the bills from, the Channel Club back in the day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you look at like, what they've got coming up in 2 weeks, and it's astounding. And I was looking at them going, I don't know, I was probably there 8 or 10 times in those 2 weeks, and elsewhere. So it's stamina in those days. It's a young man's game, that's for sure.
we all did back then, that for sure. And, it brings me right back, because, I started to hit sort of the clubs when I got into college, 85, and, mm-hmm. Whether it was the Rat or the Channel, big hangout for me was Axis
for
a lot of those industrial sort of, bands. But it was, as you said, to your point, it was such an incredible scene that you could go out Thursday, Friday, Saturday, even Sunday, and hit, all these clubs, And no matter if you just walked in, there was going to be a good band no matter what, you know, generally.
Yeah, I mean, and actually, you know, you're saying like the primary nights to go out, and you're right, I suppose. But hell, there were great shows Monday and Tuesday.
There were.
I mean, it was, you know, it was sort of wherever Boston fell on a band's itinerary, I suppose. So yeah, I mean, a weekend or near a weekend is ideal for everybody concerned. But there were great shows, you know, all the time. You know, and I don't mean to paint this, you know, with a, you know, a brush of my God, everything was wonderful all the time. Because I mean, there was crap shows too, of course. But just the level of quality, the percentage of quality was just so high, and I think those of us that were in the mix were just so excited to have that be happening. And of course, in the back of your mind, you go, my God, how long can this last? Is this the new normal? Will this stay with us forever? And of course, the answer is, well, no. But man, what a great ride.
It was an awesome ride. And I'm just like flipping through, you know, the book here. There's like these incredible black and white images. There are a couple of color ones thrown in here as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, Wendy O from the Plasmatics. I mean, there's a whole bunch of these great, you know, photos from her. I never had the chance to see her live. It would have been an incredible performance, I'm sure. Did you ever get to see Wendy O?
Yeah, I did a couple of times, talked to her some, did some writing about them. It's different schools of thought on what they did. To be honest, at the time, it didn't impress me that much because I thought the music wasn't great. I thought it was so dependent on the stage show that it was nothing you would go to the show and then go want to play at home, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean.
Right.
You'd be like, okay, you know, yeah, it was kind of fun to watch the excitement on stage. And, you know, it was, to me, a very calculated act with the sex and violence and... You know, again, yeah, sure, it's fun seeing a car get chopped up with a chainsaw or a nearly naked Wendy, you know, flopping around up there. But it was also sort of, you know, almost a caricature of punk rock, too, and punk rock outrage. So, you know, and that's okay. I mean, I'm all right with that, too. It's just, and the other thing, too, I remember, because of who they were, I remember seeing shows where it wasn't punk rock fans that went to the show. It was college frat boys wanting to see TNA. It really was. It was just an awful lot of that.
Well, yeah. So, yeah. Wendy O, known for that.
Yeah, so the vibe itself was, you know, pretty voyeuristic, I think, in many ways. But.
You had a great part in your essay where you talk about, you know, meeting Joe Strummer from The Clash backstage in 1979.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about that night, that moment, and what it meant to you, and how and why it got into the book.
Well, one of the best shows of my life. I mean, it wasn't their first U.S. show, but it was, what, the third or fourth, I think. And... you know, 1979, of course, there was no tour on the first album because it hadn't really come out. It was import only at that point. So it was the Give 'Em Enough Rope tour,
right?
Which had some terrific songs. Often it's been, I think, slagged off wrongly by many people. I thought it was a great album, still do. So anyway, there was that anticipation of hearing those songs and then the ones that we had bought the import for, which we knew by heart as well. They started off the show with, it couldn't have done it with a better song, I'm So Bored with the USA. And their boredom was different than our boredom. When I talked to Strummer about the song, it went through different iterations, but it started off as an anti-love song called I'm So Bored with You. Mm-hmm. And then I think other band members chipped in like, hey, how about the USA. Oh, okay. Well, what's boring there? Well, what was boring to them was England was getting pumped full of US TV cop shows. And that's where the line killers in America work 7 days a week. It wasn't so much about violence, real life violence on the streets of America. It was more like what they see on TV in America pumped into England. But anyway, I digress. The mood was just ecstatic. It was everybody was just so ready for this. They were so on. I talked with them afterwards. I was doing a big feature for Sweet Potato at the time, and it's since been repurposed, actually. There's a website called The Hard Noise where you can find a lot of that story now, too. I kind of rewrote it and added some things from it. And then I used it, obviously, in the intro to this book, just because it was such a seminal time for we here to, you know, be part of... Yeah, I'm not going to say the most important band in the world or the only band that matters, which was the, you know, the record company line that they put out. But they were damn good. They were right up at the top. And to participate in that, and participate, I think, is a good word. It wasn't just sitting back and watching. It was, you felt like they were you and you were them.
Absolutely. I mean, in The Clash, I mean, it speaks, you know, to me, to our generations. You may know, speaking of The Clash, of a local Boston-based Clash tribute band called Charlie Don't Surf. And if you haven't heard of them, I'll send you a link to their website, Facebook page.
Okay.
But the lead singer embodies Joe Strummer. Looks,
really?
Acts, walks like him, speaks like him. And we actually did a concert with them. We called it Rock the Lot about two summers ago. They were our very first band. We had about 200 people here, hot, sweaty, outdoor, you know, broadcasting like, you know, BCN used to do.
Sure.
But, you know, and that's, I mean, The Clash, you know, wherever they, you know, if you could see them at the Rat or the Orpheum, it was, you know, spectacular. And that's what this book, I think, does, the punk, post-punk, new wave. You bring back to life what it was like in those, you know, glorious days of the whole DIY scene in Boston, you and Michael Greco.
Yeah, I think, well, Michael, I mean, my job, I mean, basically, I look at it this way. I mean, it's Michael's book. He scored the goal and I had the assist, I
right.
think, the way to look at it.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, and I mean, you know, he sent me the proofs of the pictures, what was going to go in the book. So obviously that served as, you know, at least an inspiration for where I was going to go. So what I wanted to do in the text is just, you know, yes, both illustrate what he was putting in photos, and also to go a little bit beyond it, maybe a little bit deeper into some of the intellectual elements that went into the scene.
Absolutely.
And also some of the tawdry elements that went into the scene, too. There were people that talked about the sex and drugs and rock and roll part of it, that the hedonistic part that was there along with the nihilistic part. And there were just so many different avenues of this scene and different sounds within the genre, if you want to just call it a genre or an expanded genre, the things that were accompanied or encompassed by punk rock was just, you know, an extremely wide range from, you know, Ian Dury to the Ramones, to the Members, to, I mean, you know, and a whole lot of bands that really, you know, turned out to have very short lifespans, maybe one-shot wonders, whatever you want to call them. But there was just a slew of just, you know, great 45s and things coming out. And then the bands, if they come into your town, well, there you go. You know, you get to experience that live.
It was a great time. Question I ask, you know, especially for people like yourself from the Boston area, and, you know, different cities, they have their sort of, you know, music mecca scene for however, like a decade or so. Do you think, as you sort of look out at the future, and I also want to find out what you're doing now and going forward, do you think that Boston will have that type of scene again, or is that just, you know, it's seared into our memories? It was a great time. Just things have changed because of social media, and especially with COVID, obviously. But, you know, what if you were, you know, forecasting out what might the music scene in Boston look like in a couple of years?
Well, I picked B, your second part there. I mean, I think what we went through was a very special time that had to do with the tenor of the times itself, the Reagan years, the Thatcher years, the way unemployment was, the way opportunities for people were very restricted, the way the media had not developed the way it has now,
right,
with the internet taking so much of our time, our space, our bandwidth, our lives, and with the access to music on Spotify or YouTube or Deezer or however you want to get it, everything in the world is at your fingertips, right? So you can do it that way and find things, and I mean, certainly bands have built huge audiences that way, but it's a whole lot different than putting out a 45,
right,
an album, and slogging around America from club to club, building an audience, coming back, seeing it build more, etc. So, I mean, it's not, I mean, again, with COVID, right, of course, there's nothing. The last thing I saw was Pogetry, the Pogues Pogues-ish Cajun band led by Spider Stacy, the tin whistle player. And it was damn good. It was a City Winery March 2nd or 3rd or something
like
that. Wow,
right before.
Yeah, it was right before. It was the last show I saw. Great fun. And, you know, Spider and I know each other. We threw our arms around each other, took the obligatory picture. And it's like, oh, this is good. It's, throw this in the library, add this to it. And then, you know, a few weeks later realizing, oh, that's it. Mm. Or it for the foreseeable future. So, you know, it's tough, you know, in looking ahead, it really is hard to look beyond COVID. I've done a number of stories on what is, what, you know, club owners, what bands, agents, managers predict about the future. And it ain't good. It's the, as the saying goes, the clubs were the first to close and they'll be the last to open.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, what, you know, yes, vaccine, great, good, on the way, coming soon. You know, when will we reach a point where enough people have it? And when will that be a point where we feel comfortable gathering in large groups, mm-hmm. intimate groups, sharing the kind of intimacy we always used to? Don't know the answer to that, and no one does. I mean, there are artists that are booking dates in, you know, mid-2021. Might happen, might not. You know, it's such a big question mark. So, you know, it's hard to envision the safe and sane world post-COVID and what that music scene might be like. It's certainly, obviously, a different scene than the one that you and I were talking about.
Absolutely.
In our youth. And frankly, I mean, it's not one I'm necessarily part of at all, except as more of an observer. Back, I mean, in those days, I was an observer, a critic, and a participant. These days, I'm curious. I like to see great new bands, but I don't have the kind of wherewithal to dig through it as I once did.
Right, right. So we've got about 5 minutes left,
sure.
And I want, you know, it's a great book, Punk, Post-Punk, New Wave, Michael Greco, Jim Sullivan, forward by Fred Schneider of the B-52s. But you're also doing some really cool stuff now. Tell us a little bit about that. And you mentioned before we got on the air about Shane McGowan.
Yeah, well, one of the main things I'm doing right now is writing for the WBUR arts website called The Artery. I've been doing that for, I don't know, 5 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good arts site, and especially as my old paper, The Globe, has, shall we say, diminished or de-emphasized arts and music coverage even before COVID,
mm-hmm.
The Artery's kind of picked up the ball. It's a different thing, and I mean, I'm not really comparing the two because it's a whole different ball of wax, but it's a very good place to be. I'd recommend people check it out for a variety of reasons. What I've got coming up is, I have not watched the movie yet. I just got a stream of it. It's the Shane McGowan story. It is called Crock of Gold, A Few Rounds with Shane McGowan. And it's by Julian Temple, the guy who did the Sex Pistols Rock and Roll Swindle movie.
Sure.
And apparently, haven't watched it, don't know, but apparently a lot of it has to do, or the subtext is Julian kind of trying to get Shane to sit to do an interview in real time, in current time. So a lot of it, I think, is going to revolve around archival footage, mm-hmm. and which is fine, but I don't think he's got the current Shane there in the movie. He may. I may be wrong. He may have gotten him for something. So anyway, it is an unvarnished look at the enigma that is Shane McGowan, and I, of course, have a few stories of spending time with Shane, most of them good. want me to give you one real quick?
Yeah, definitely.
It's a little sad. Can I give you would you like a sad story?
You know, 2020, why not?
All right. It's a little sad. Probably the last time I saw them at Avalon, I guess it would have been
at
the time.
Yep.
And we were backstage or upstairs. We're sitting on the banquette upstairs. I'm there. Shane's manager, Joey Cashman, is sitting to my right. Shane's at my left. There's bottles of booze everywhere. And, you know, people milling about here and there. And, I mean, I have known both of them for quite some time. I met them back in 85 in London when I was there for a bit. And, you know, we get on well. And so I was talking to Joey about, you know, he seemed very up and excited. I said, what's up? He said, I won't try to do the accent. He said, Shane and I, we just, you know, we went through rehab, heroin rehab, and we have kicked it. You know, we kicked it. We went together and we kicked it. So, you know, he was feeling really good about his newfound sobriety,
mm-hmm.
commitment to it. And, you know, so I said, that's terrific, congratulations, Joe. And I just kind of turned over to, around to Shane, and, you know, kind of naively perhaps, I don't know. But I said, so, Shane, how about you? And he just kind of gives me this look and goes, oh, if you had some, I'd do it.
Ouch.
You know, and he wasn't joking. I mean, yeah. You know, it was like, if I had some heroin and was willing to share, sure. You know, so it was sort of, okay. And then, as the evening wound down, and we were told, you know, time to clear out. True story. Shane got a plastic garbage bag and gathered up all the liquor bottles, half full or full liquor bottles that were there on the band's rider, put them in a bag and clunked them and clanked them down the stairs and went off to their hotel or wherever they were going to.
It's not always a glamorous life, is it?
No.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, Shane's an addict and an alcoholic. And, I mean, he's brilliant. One of the best songwriters to come. You know, I mean, I really admire the man and what he's done as a writer. And it's kind of astonishing that he's been able to do the kind of work he's done under the sort of, you know, diminished capacity that alcohol will bring. But, you know, it's obviously been an inspiration for him as well. It's just, you know, perhaps... it went too far.
So for the project that you're working on about Shane McGowan, how will that be through the artery? Or?
Yeah, that'll be an artery story. It'll be coming. I'm writing it up this weekend. It'll be posted sometime next week. I'm guessing probably Wednesday.
Oh, okay, cool. So we'll, I'll keep an eye out for it. I'll share it on the 80s Alternative Radio Facebook page, all that type of stuff.
Yeah.
And a great, if people are looking for a gift to give to a friend or a loved one, I highly recommend The Punk Post-Punk New Wave by Michael Greco and you, Jim Sullivan. It'd be a great to open that up under a Christmas tree, I think.
Well, you know what I'd say, too, and I mean, this is probably a bit of the thrust, is that for people like you and me, Chris, I mean, having been there for it and experienced it firsthand, yes, it brings back memories, and yes, there's a certain nostalgia aspect to it, and even if nostalgia, you know, is Lux Interior taking his, you know, willy out of his pants. But for people who are younger, generations or two under, you know, millennials, Gen X, well, Gen X maybe, millennials, whoever, this is new stuff.
Right.
And
absolutely.
I've got to think through, for their eyes, they're looking through this. They've got to be looking at it with a sense of wonder, maybe even fear, like, whoa, this looks both exciting and scary. And, you know, like, wow, I wonder what it was like to be part of that. And I think maybe that's the great thing about the book, in a way, is, I mean, Greco's photographs and my text and Fred's kind of bring you in there. And my hope is that if you are, you know, 22, 3, or 4, or something like that, and just kind of have heard about this stuff and are curious, somebody gives you this as a Christmas present, you get to go, hey, whoa, okay, let me dive into this. And then, of course, since everything's available online, you can listen to your heart's content.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Jim, it's been great having you kind of bring us back to those days, talk obviously about the, you know, the current state of music and your new project about Shane McGowan out sometime next week in The Artery.
Yes.
So we appreciate that. And, you know, whenever this COVID goes away, perhaps we'll have you come on down live in the studio to talk about some other projects you're working on.
That would be
a lot of fun.
That would be fun. You know what you really ought to do right now, Chris?
What's that?
Kick into Sonic Reducer. Give those guys a big blast.
I will definitely do that. How did you know that I had that queued up?
I don't know. Just intuition. You know, rock writer intuition.
All right. Well, Jim, great chatting with you. Hold on. I'll talk to you offline in about 10 seconds.
Okay.
And, so we were chatting with Jim Sullivan. Great book out with Michael Greco, Punk, Post-Punk, New Wave. Check it out at your local retailer, bookstore, and wrap it up and put under a tree. All right, 95.9 WATD, Sonic Reducer, Dead Boys, ATD.